This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about sleep as a factor in mental health. So to start off with, I've got some stats from the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. They carried out a study in which they found the majority of adults with stress-induced sleep problems experience this at least once per week, and more than half experience this several times a week. Also, 75% of adults whose sleep is affected by stress or anxiety say that their sleep problems have also increased their stress and anxiety. 54% say that stress or anxiety increase their anxiety about falling asleep at night. There are just a few stats I wanted to pick out from that study in particular, mainly because they really illustrate the vicious cycle of how being anxious or stressed can make it more difficult for us to sleep, as can many sleep conditions. And that in turn can cause us to be more anxious, more stressed because of lack of sleep. And so this thing kind of cycles round in a loop.
Yeah.
Is this something you've experienced, Annie?
Oh my God, yeah, absolutely. Like there are so many nights where I've just been lying awake in bed until like 4 a.m, just like my brain is ticking over. I'm like, why won't you turn off, please? For the love of God, let me go to sleep. I really suffer with really bad insomnia, living with fibromyalgia. Often, like, the pain is so much that I just can't fall asleep, no matter how many painkillers I take or no matter what I do. Or sometimes the fatigue is so great that I'm kind of overtired and kind of like a really hyped up and wired toddler on the inside. So I just won't fall asleep, no matter. It just is literally just a waiting game. I've laid in bed for hours and hours and hours trying to fall asleep, and I've actually found one of the things that's been really helpful is just saying, you know what, fine, if you don't fall asleep, then fine, I'll get up and do something. And then usually within like an hour, I'm ready to drift off. Just like a bit of housework even, or like just going into a different room. I find that I really struggle with like heat and stuffiness in the bedroom. Like our bedroom is double glazed, whereas the rest of the house isn't. So often I'll go into the living room and just like chill myself like a little cake. So I'm ready to fall asleep. I really can't fall asleep if it's too stuffy. Sleep can be so difficult. I mean, particularly if you're living with mental illness or any kind of illness for that matter. And it just seems so cruel and unfair that not only are we living with an illness, we're not able to get restful sleep at night as well. It's just like, really?
Right. And that's why I thought it was so important to cover this, because it's really universal, not only if you're dealing with mental ill health, but just being a day-to-day human. Having sleep is so fundamental to every part of our health, every part of our productivity and general well-being. So for me, it's such an obvious factor. And with managing my own mental health, getting a good night's sleep every night, although it's not always possible, tends to be one of the biggest factors in really how my mental health is set up for the following day.
Absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. Like, that's exactly my experience.
One thing we've mentioned off air that we have in common, using like audiobooks or podcasts or music to help us fall asleep.
Yeah. Right? I love me some of that. I love an audiobook. I find like with audiobooks, I kind of feel like I'm missing out on something, unless it's like a really boring topic, I guess. But like I tend to fall asleep listening to like TV shows that I've already seen 100 times. So like Friends or like Will and Grace, like something that's just like, I've seen this 1,000 times. I'm definitely not missing anything. Or like The Simpsons or something. Or like often my partner will fall asleep listening to like really complicated maths videos because he finds them really soothing and really, I mean, sorry, maths guys, but they're super boring to us anyway. So we often fall asleep listening to like fractals. We're like, oh yeah, give me some of that sweet fractal goodness. And I don't think I've ever said that sentence before in my life, and I don't know if I ever will again. It's a first here on Mental Podcast.
I don't know what a fractal is, so that...
Yeah. Well, neither do I. I just know that they're very complicated.
Well, that's it. I think listening to maths problems, trying to go to sleep would stress me out and have the opposite effect. But I think you mentioned listening to stuff that you've seen before, and I think there's definitely a lot to that. So for me,
yeah,
I will listen to like audiobooks that I've listened to before, because there's a kind of familiarity and a reassurance in that. And
yeah.
It's kind of safe. You already know what's happening. You don't feel you're going to miss anything. And particularly when our minds are whirring, it can be really helpful just to interrupt that with someone else's voice.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, actually. Like the interruption, when you said that, I was like, yes, that makes so much sense for me.
Mm-hmm. One that my personal recommendation would be, I love Whoopi Goldberg in general.
Whoopi, I love her so much. Oh.
But specifically, she wrote a book all about relationships, which I've read several times and has become one of my go-tos if I am struggling to get to sleep, because she has a brilliant voice that sounds very reassuring and relaxing to me, but also you can slow it down when listening to an audiobook, and so then it's extra restful.
Oh yeah, you can slow speeds down on the apps, can't you? Oh, I love that.
Luckily I don't have an experience of struggling to sleep regularly, but it is something I have so much empathy for, because it's really universal how stressful it can be struggling to get to sleep, you know. And for me, one of the worst things I can do is check the time. Like yourself, I'm better off just getting out of the room, just accepting I'm not ready for it yet, and then coming back when I'm a bit more tired.
Stop fighting it, just get on with it. Like, if your body doesn't want to sleep, then be like, fine, if you can't beat it, join it, you know what I mean?
Right, you can't concentrate harder and that somehow be conducive to sleep. It doesn't work like that. So this week, I'm really delighted to speak to Lorna O'Connor, and she has somnophobia. So if you haven't heard of that before, that is a type of phobia, specifically a fear of sleep. And there can be a whole range of things that cause this. So I did a bit of digging and found some more information from fearof.net. So I'll just paraphrase a little bit from them. The fear of sleep is related to the fear of the unknown. Often the sufferer is terrified of what might happen if they fall asleep or feel out of control by being asleep. Many are afraid of having nightmares or fear being unable to hear their loved ones call out to them. Somnophobia is related to a host of other phobias like fear of sleepwalking, nightmares, dying in sleep, sleep paralysis, plus existing anxiety disorders and PTSD. So the thing really to highlight here is sleep conditions can be just so severe, but also they don't always exist in a bubble. They can really easily interact with other conditions like PTSD is mentioned there.
Mm.
For many people suffering with that condition, being alone in a quiet room trying to go to sleep can be a really difficult time, because past thoughts and experiences that are traumatic come to the surface, and in that silence it can be really difficult to get away from them, to distract yourself. It can be difficult enough just having one of these conditions, but when they start to interact, or when sleep conditions affect your mental health in general, that's when it can get so much more complicated and difficult to deal with. So I'm so glad to be covering this topic today. Is there anything else you wanted to mention, Annie, before we jump into the episode?
No, I'm super excited to get into this interview. Let's just get into it.
Cool. All right. So we'll get into the episode with Lorna O'Connor in just a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Lorna. I kind of consider that I've had mental health problems my entire life. I struggle to think of a time when I haven't had them, particularly issues with my sleep, which we'll talk about in a little bit. I was quite an emotional child, quite anxious growing up. And then when I went to secondary school, I kind of tried to get a little bit of help for those problems, but it was dismissed quite a lot. And it was only really when I went to university that things came to a big head. Story I'm sure you've heard before.
Well, that's very similar to me as
it's so sad that it's the same for everyone. I think when you're away from home for the first time, everything that you've been kind of running from comes seeping out, or at least it did for me. I really started to struggle with my sleep at university a lot, and from there became very, very anxious, withdrawn, stopped seeing my friends at all, quite paranoid, low mood. And it got to a point where a friend came round and was like, actually, I think you need to leave. I think you need to go home and get some help. And she actually physically grabbed my bag and was like, get on the train. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm fine, leave me alone. She was like, you're not fine. And she was like, come on, we're getting in the car, we're going to the train station. And I was like, okay. And then I got diagnosed initially with depression and anxiety. I had to suspend my studies for a year, which sucked. I developed anorexia. I was denied treatment for anorexia because my BMI wasn't classified as underweight. It was healthy, so my doctor said he couldn't do anything about that.
Yeah, that's something we mentioned on a recent episode, yeah, how unjust that is.
All too common. It's actually quite scary how common that is. I think I saw a tweet earlier that someone had the same experience today.
Oh, wow.
It's scary. And then I don't really know how I got better. I always say that I don't really know how things got better. I think I just had a very supportive family. I went back to university after taking a year out. And
can we just pause a little bit before that? So I had a similar experience when I was briefly at university. I didn't manage a term even, where I had a really supportive friend that may have not known necessarily that my like mental health was as bad as it was, but knew I wasn't myself, having only known me for a relatively short period of time. And did you find with your friend, you kind of knew that you were bad when she highlighted it? Or was that something you were sort of still a little bit hiding from at the time?
I just remember being really surprised that anyone had noticed and that anyone actually cared enough to say anything. It was a really, really dark time. It was kind of preempted by a fight with a housemate over who made it to the toilet first, which still makes me laugh. I'm like, oh my God, as if I had a breakdown over that. But I describe it as a breakdown. And I didn't leave my room for over 24 hours. I didn't go to the toilet. I didn't eat. I didn't drink. I didn't do anything. I just sat in bed and cried for about a day. And then she came round and I was really surprised that she'd noticed that anything was wrong. I don't know. I can't remember whether I messaged her or whether my housemates had messaged her and said something's not right. But I just remember her being there and bringing me a chocolate bar. And I was so surprised that she cared. And when she said it, I was kind of like, initially I was like, no, I'm fine. I think I've been in denial for a really long time. And I was like, I'm fine. Leave me alone. Like, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just sad.
Right.
And then when she said it again, I was like, okay, she looks really serious now. Maybe something isn't right. And then when she was like, no, you need to leave, I was like, oh, I guess something is wrong. And I kind of thought, oh, I'll just go home for a few days, I'll see a doctor, they'll give me some pills and I'll be fine. But I think actually she almost like opened this entire like flood barrier, and suddenly I was like, oh, I can't manage this anymore. And actually, I don't think I can go back to uni right now. And I think I need to address some things that have been going on for quite a while that I probably hadn't even accepted myself at the time. So she kind of forced me. I always say she backed me into a corner, but I'm so glad that she did, because I don't think I'd have realised without her. I was really in denial.
I get that. And it's interesting what you mentioned there about not believing that anyone would care, because that's quite universal, whatever mental illness you're dealing with, that when you're at your very worst, you don't think people care, and you don't frequently think you're worth the care in the first place.
Yeah.
The self-worth can often be the first thing to go.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how profound it was for you, her highlighting that she did care and that she did see that you were struggling. And and it sounded like exactly what you needed at the time.
Yeah. I always say that was a real, well, that was the turning point for me. And we don't speak anymore, me and that friend, not through any issues. We've just drifted apart in life after uni. But every year on that day, I send her a message saying thank you. And I'm just like, you changed my entire life. And you probably don't even remember that this happened. But for me, it was everything. And it didn't take a lot on her part. I think that's always the thing, is she didn't have a clue. She didn't really say anything. She didn't tell me what I needed to do. She just noticed and cared enough to tell me, and had the courage to tell me, because I know it wasn't easy.
Yeah, that's so lovely. And it highlights an important thing that we talk about on the podcast quite a lot, that you don't have to have all the answers to be supportive.
No.
Sometimes it is just showing up for someone. Sometimes it's just being a good listener. And that's all it takes to kind of get them onto the path of recovery. And it sounds like that really is the way it went for you. And so then you were going to talk a little bit about then leaving uni and what happened there.
So I went back to uni for my last 2 years and had a series of disastrous Tinder relationships. And as a result of some of those relationships, or more my reaction to those ending relationships, I got re-diagnosed with borderline personality disorder.
Okay.
And that was terrifying at the time. I was doing a psychology degree and I thought I knew what borderline personality disorder was, and I really didn't. And I remember my doctor telling me, and she was like, what do you do again? And I was like, I study psychology, why? And she was like, don't panic. I was like, oh God, what are you going to say? And then she was like, I think you might have borderline personality disorder. And I was like, so you're calling me a psychopath? And she was like, no. Oh, well, what is it then? So that was quite a scary time.
Yeah, well, there can be so much stigma, particularly around that condition. And for me, I think a lot of it does come around to two of the three words being personality disorder.
Yeah.
It's difficult to not take that as a personal fault, at least at some point during diagnosis. And of course, it's not.
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things to deal with. Now, I knew the term, I'd heard it. But when I tell my friends now, they've never heard of it. And they're just like, I don't know what that is. And they're like, what are you talking about? Your personality's disordered. How can that be a thing? And I'm just like, oh, it doesn't really mean that, but it does and it doesn't. And I'm just like, I still don't really know how to explain it. I saw a doctor the other day and she said she was a medical student and she didn't really know what it was. And she was like, can you explain what that is to me? And I was just like, no, not really. Sorry.
Google it. Your job.
Yeah, I was like, use the computer and look it up because no, I can't. And I think it really does take such a long time to get your head around. It takes a lot of reflecting on, like, I'm very aware of why I have it and the things that happened in my life that mean I have it, but that in itself has been a really painful experience at times, to look back at some of the trauma that happened in my early life that means that I have the learned behaviours that I have now. As well, it doesn't have the respect of other mental illnesses. I used to work in psychiatry and a lot of the time it was, oh, he's got a mental illness and he's got a personality disorder, and I'm like, but neither of them want to be the way they are. Neither of them are in control of how they are.
That's really sad. They're separating it into a separate category.
Yeah, it's something I hear a lot. Mental illness and personality disorders as two completely separate things. And I'm like, I just want to be normal like everyone else. And I'm not choosing to behave the way that I am.
Yeah. And you brought up the example earlier of relationships, and I mean Tinder relationships are drama at the best of times, but I think that's one of the things that makes this condition so difficult, is for being in a romantic relationship, your partner, I think, to a certain extent just has to understand it, because your emotions are going to be in flux a lot more than theirs, and they're not going to always be able to see logical links between an action they made and your reaction to it.
I'm in a relationship now. I met him on Tinder 4 years ago, though, so we're okay.
Okay, so it does work.
In the end, yeah, it took a lot of... My mum always says, she gave me a statue of a frog for one of my birthdays and said, you had to kiss a lot of me to find him. And I'm like, yeah, you're not going anywhere because I ain't going back on Tinder. You've got to stay with me now.
no pressure.
Yeah, I'm not going back on Tinder ever again. But he struggles with the irrationality of it. He's a very, very logical person and he wants to understand why things are the way they are. And I think that's what's I've had to do a lot of self-reflection, because I've had to explain, well, I behave like this when this happens because this happened when I was four. He has had to understand the process to get into that diagnosis as much as I have, because otherwise he'd just be like, I don't get what you're doing. Why are you being like this? And he's taken the time to do that, but it's been a learning curve for both of us. We've both had to adapt to different things. One of the difficulties with him is that his strategy when he's annoyed is to just walk away, and for me that's like the last thing I need. I'm like, no, stay here, we need to fight. And he's like, no, I'm going. And I'm like, don't just walk away from me. And it's been really hard, but we have adapted and we are managing.
And that unfortunately can be quite typical, that response in men, because I think that's one of the few tools, however maladaptive it can be, that we're taught by society and by the kind of male stereotypes that, you know, bottling something up or just leaving an emotional situation is how you get around it. And of course it's not.
Yeah, we're very, very different. And I think bringing the two together, the two different emotional responses together, has been bloody hard.
Because in many ways that's the opposite. Like you really struggling to separate your emotions a lot of the time, compared to your default coping mechanism being walking away from the emotions. I bet that's something that at times you've wished you were able to just do.
Yeah, as well. When we have an argument, I assume he's going to leave, and I assume that's the end of our relationship. Even now, 4 years on, I'm like, oh, well, that's us then. And he's like, no, it's an argument. Like, calm down, I'm not going to leave. And I'm like, why? And I can't. I really struggle with that. And for me, it's all or nothing. And so if things are bad, they're over. And if they're good, then they're fantastic and we're going to be together forever. But he's just very like, there's a lot more in between. And I'm just like, no, there's not. It's one or the other. And I think for him, he really struggles to understand why my brain goes to the extremes so much.
And as you've learned to understand it better, have you been able to tell to what extent that's to do with the illness and to what extent that's to do with your experience growing up?
Yeah, I think so. I think I always see my own, and this might not be true for everyone else, but I see my borderline personality disorder as very much a response to my early life and experiences that have happened since. And so I can unpick it. It doesn't necessarily always mean I have the answers as to how to fix it, but I can unpick it and I can make sense of it. And I think that's something that perhaps his logical brain has helped me to do. And it's actually even just understanding why I do the things I do is helpful a lot of the time.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sort of reminded of an interview we just did before this one of talking about counselling. And it's almost in a similar kind of way, you having to explain to a significant other your thought processes and where your emotions are regularly is helping you put them in order. You know, just the power of saying these things out loud and putting them in a in a sentence
definitely
can make so much more sense to you. So we've got a pretty good idea of where you are in your background, and particularly your worst period being university. Am I right in remembering that's also where somnophobia came into your life as well?
That was when it was certainly at the worst.
Do you remember where you perhaps first experienced it?
So I, from my mother's account, I have always struggled with sleep. But for me, I grew up in a home with a lot of domestic violence. You wouldn't have known. We were a very normal looking family. Quite a big house in the country, semi-detached house, own home, mother, father, brother. We looked normal. But my dad, I believe, had his own mental health problems. He was quite physically unwell for a lot of my life, and I think he felt like a failure. It's funny, I was listening to one of your interviews earlier and you mentioned that your family are Irish. He was Irish and he was a very proud man. And when he became physically unwell, I think he felt very angry at the world that he couldn't do the things that he saw as being a man. Like he couldn't bring in money for the house, he couldn't look after us the way he wanted to, and I think he felt really angry about that. And that got taken out on us in a similar way that I think his parents had done to him. And like a lot of families with domestic violence, my parents tried to protect me by sending me up to bed when they started to argue. So I, a lot of my childhood was spent listening to terrifying noises that I didn't know what they were and I couldn't make sense of as a child. And that filled me with absolute fear, even though I didn't know what it was. I vividly remember listening to horrific fights and not having a clue whether my mum was alive or not. I didn't necessarily think that he was going to do that, but I think as a child you're just like, oh my god, is something bad going to happen? And so that was when kind of bed started to become a place of real anxiety for me. And then when I was 9 years old, I woke up one morning at about 6 o'clock and I thought my mum and dad were having a fight. They had lots of fights, so I was just like, oh, here we go again. Really, it's really early, I want to go back to sleep. But very quickly realised it wasn't a fight, that my dad was really unwell. And then the ambulance arrived and the paramedics came in, and my dad was actually having a heart attack that turned out to be fatal. And he passed away at about 6:30 in the morning, and I went to school that day. I don't know why, I chose to. And I think after that, I vividly remember being 9 years old and being so aware that bad things happen at night. And just being terrified when I got into bed that my mum was going to die, or my brother was going to die, or somebody was going to break in, and just all these thoughts that I couldn't control. And I remember, my mum's going to kill me. My mum snores. She says she doesn't, but she does. She definitely snores. And I remember sitting up at 9 years old at night, at like 2 a.m, listening to her snoring just to make sure she was alive, and being so scared that she was going to die as well. And I think that just became a pattern. And it didn't last forever, but I just remember always being scared of going to bed.
Yeah, because one thing I was thinking about, even before your dad passed, there was, you mentioned briefly, worrying that your parents might kill each other.
Yeah.
That you didn't kind of entertain it as being truth, but it was still a concern.
Yeah.
And so was there ever a point you were doing that even beforehand, that if I go to sleep now and I'm not listening to my parents, something might happen to one of them while I sleep?
Yeah, probably. And I think it's quite scary for me to think of that now. I know people with like kids of a similar age, and I'm like, bloody hell. I was really young, but at the time it was just my normal. And I just remember being like almost similarly waiting for them to go to bed and it being over and the row being over and them going to bed and going about their normal business and things being okay again. But I had to hear it end. And I think I'm still quite similar now. Whenever there's a noise, I have to know what it is. And like, I work in a very busy environment. And I'm like, what was that? And people are like, what was what? Yeah. And I still feel like I have to know what's going on when it's over, how it ended in a way, and that everyone is safe. I'm very anxious about everybody being safe all the time. And like, if my boyfriend doesn't text me, I'm like, oh my God, he's dead. And I'm like constantly ringing him. But it's just...
Because in many ways it sounds that you... looking out for your parents became the norm.
Yeah.
That you had to sort of step into that adult role of, I'm not confident they can look after themselves. Yeah. And it, unfortunately, it sounds like it was right based on what they were going through.
Yeah. And I think I've gone through so many periods of hating my dad, but I really understand now that he wasn't well and that he was struggling. And I don't justify what he did for a single minute at all. But I kind of get it, but to put that on two children is very difficult. But I also, I want to talk about it because I know that so many kids have gone through it. And actually, for a really long time, I pretended it didn't happen. I pretended when my dad died, I was like, you don't speak ill of the dead. So that was very much the attitude in my family. So I was like, no, he was great. And he was a lot of the time, but he was also had a really bad temper and beat the shit out of us at times. And I was just like, this didn't happen. He was fine. Our family were great. We were all happy. And now he's gone. And it's the worst thing in the world. And actually, that's not the reality. And that's not the reality for a lot of people. And I think when I started opening up about the fact that I'd grown up in a house with domestic violence, I was surprised at the number of people that I knew that also said the same thing that I would never have guessed.
Yeah.
Because their families seem like mine. They seem really normal on the outside.
But that's it, you never quite know what's going on behind closed doors, and particularly with domestic violence, the hiding it goes hand in hand. It's, you can't essentially commit domestic violence sustainably without learning how to hide it. It won't last.
And I have no idea how long it went on for, when it started. I just remember that being, I mean, for all I know, it happened a year before my dad died, but I remember it being my entire childhood. And just this constant feeling of fear. My dad was of the opinion that children should be seen and not heard. So me and my brother would spend a lot of time playing in his bedroom because he had the bigger bedroom. And I remember, like, if we were laughing too loudly and things like that, he'd come up the stairs and scream at us. I don't remember if he ever laid a hand on us, but he would be angry. And so even being in my brother's room provoked a sense of fear that you have to be keeping one ear on the door almost, or one ear on the stairs, to kind of check that everything's safe. And that just continued. And when I was probably about 14, I moved from the upstairs of my house to the downstairs because I said it was too noisy. And I think now what I meant is that that noise caused me so much anxiety that I could not manage it. And so I wanted to be on a floor of our house by myself where there was no noise. And I didn't have to worry about, is my mum breathing? Is my brother okay? In the next room, I could just go to sleep. And that worked for a bit until I went to uni.
Yeah. And one thing I wanted to highlight there was with your dad and how he reacted towards you, and that kind of children should be seen but not heard is very conducive to control. That in many ways, it sounds to me as an outsider like you were being brought up in the style to which he wants your mum to behave. That by you following his rules and being passive and going along with his toxic behaviour, it's not going to disrupt him and how he wants to behave. In that
and
moment.
I remember seeing bruises on my brother and being told not to tell anyone when we were at the same school what they were from. And I don't remember what had happened, but I have no doubt in my mind that that was, don't tell them that your dad did this, or don't tell. I have no idea whether he hit me or not. I have no memory of it, but that might be because it's too painful to remember. But
yeah, and that can be a completely normal response to filter that stuff out in hindsight.
But I always say there was no room for my emotions in our house whatsoever. His were the priority and his were the only ones that mattered. And as awful as it sounds, my mum and me both always say that actually it was probably quite a mixed blessing that he passed away when he did, because I wouldn't be the person I am now if I was continued to have been brought up in that environment. I think I would be very quiet and very, I mean, I am anxious, but far more anxious of everything than I am.
And that's such a difficult thing to come to terms with, that you may be better off without a parent, because it's not even necessarily just how we're raised. It's the society we live in. There's these kind of perceived unbreakable rules, like parents should not hurt their children. You should always be better off with two parents in your life. And that's not the reality for many, many people.
No. I'm very thankful for the good sides of my dad, but actually it was perhaps his behaviour, and his behaviour alone would have been enough. It wasn't the only factor, but it certainly would have been enough to have caused all of my issues with my mental health. And there's no escaping that. And that actually, if he'd have continued to be around, things might have been a lot worse.
Yeah. It's tricky because particularly when you've got that experience of people saying you can't speak ill of the dead. Yeah, just because somebody dies does not then mean they're perfect.
Yeah, that's something I only come to terms with really recently, probably in the last 6 months or so, that actually, and I was on some training at Time to Change and I gave my testimony and I mentioned the domestic violence. And they asked me afterwards how I felt, and I said, that's the first time I've ever said that out loud about my dad. And I remember saying, because you don't speak ill of the dead, and one of the women at Time to Change, she's fantastic, said to me, but you're telling your story, you're not telling his. And I think that's been so powerful to me, that actually I'm telling my side of the story, and it's very different to what his is, but what he did is part of my story, and it is part of the reason that I have a mental illness. And I'd be lying if I pretended he was anything else. I find it hard that some of my family do continue to play this, but he's dead now, he was great, he was a good man, he was this. And I'm like, yeah, he was all of those things. But he was also all of these other things. And I think it's really important to remember both. With my BPD, I've gone from loving him to hating him and idolising him to despising him. And actually, I'm starting to accept somewhere in between as the reality.
Mm-hmm. So from that young age, you having this fear, the somnophobia, the fear of sleep building, and that was becoming like a nightly occurrence, am I right in thinking?
There was certainly a point, I think after my dad died, it was every single night, and I remember vividly the night he died, and I did not sleep. I think I eventually fell asleep for maybe an hour, but I didn't sleep, and that really started off this period of intense anxiety that I didn't recognise. I just thought, oh, I struggled to sleep. And when I spoke to my mum, she was like, well, you struggled to sleep as a baby, you know, your dad's just died, you're gonna. And then I didn't really think anything of it. I was just like, oh, I struggled to sleep. A lot of people do, it's not that big a deal. And then when I moved rooms, things got a lot better because there were no distractions. I could just go to sleep. But it was then when I went back to university, it almost came back, and it came back in a really, really intense way. That again was quite scary. I lived in, it was a converted house, and there were 12 of us in the house, and we didn't have ensuite, we had bathrooms upstairs, so I was on the floor with two other people, and every time they went to the toilet, I would like, almost like, it reminds me of, you know, Monsters Inc. when they have the simulator, and the kid just sits bolt upright in the bed and starts screaming. It reminded me of that. It's just like, I would just sit bolt upright. And similarly, I couldn't go back to sleep until I heard them come back to their room and I heard the door shut. And I didn't realise any of this at the time. This has all come like a lot later, that all of these things are linked and that this has been going on for most of my life. That any noise at night or anything that, you know, if I've had an argument with somebody, I really struggle to go to sleep because I'm worried that they're going to die overnight and that will be the last I ever see them or I ever say to them. I just find the whole process really, really difficult.
I was thinking, as you've talked about those experiences, in particular, living with 12 different people when you're experiencing a condition like that sounds such a nightmare to begin with. You know, how can you escape the noises?
I really don't remember in my first year. I remember it being bad, but I was only on a floor with two other people. I was quite lucky. I was on the bottom floor, so there was only three of us. And so it wasn't that bad. Like, they'd go to the toilet maybe once a night each, and I could kind of just about talk myself down. But in my second year house was a lot busier, and I think we'd all made a lot of friends, and because we were living in the city, not on campus, people were in and out a lot more, and it just became absolutely unbearable. Like, I used to have one housemate in the room next door to me, and she would come in at 10 o'clock at night, go to her room, read a book for like an hour, and then get up and go and brush her teeth. And she had a really creaky floorboard in her room, and I would just be drifting off to sleep and she'd step on it, and I would just be like bolt upright, hyperventilating, like complete panic, over the fact she was going to brush her teeth. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And it carried on every single night. And I said to her, like, I'm really sorry when you come in. Can you maybe try not to wait so long? Or can you just do it before you go to your room, read your book? And just nothing seemed to help. And then it got to the point where I was like actively sitting up and waiting for noises like that weren't even there. Like my housemate in the next room coughing, or someone downstairs, or people walking past the window. And I was just constantly like sat there, my shoulders clenched, just like, and I don't, it was just so, it felt terrifying.
Right.
And it was so irrational. Like I knew it wasn't normal, but I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't figure out where it had come from. Yeah.
And that's the difficulty, that you knew the kind of, the cause and effect in a small way of they step on this floorboard, this is how I react. But you, because you didn't have that greater context, how can you possibly translate that to someone that doesn't experience it?
Yeah.
You know, how can you explain to them how big a deal it is them stepping on that?
I honestly felt crazy because I was going to them and I was saying, can you please just not, or can you walk this way? And they're just like, it doesn't matter. And I'm just like, I know it doesn't matter to you. And I know this doesn't make sense. And I was just like, this is driving me mad. And I remember thinking, I was sat up one night, bless my housemate, she had a cold and I wanted to kill her because I was just like, shut up, because I can't sleep, because every time you cough you're making me have a panic attack. And I was just like, this is insane, I cannot live like this. And it also felt really claustrophobic because I just felt surrounded by noises everywhere that you don't ever tune into. But suddenly I was just like, oh my god, this is deafening. And I'm like, it's not, it's her coughing, or it's my housemate downstairs like picking up a plate. And I'm just, it was just bonkers. I went to the GP on campus and I said to him, I can't sleep. And I said, and I honestly believe I was sat up at the night before at like 4 a.m. and I texted my mum saying, if this carries on, I can't live like this. And she rang me and she was like, you're not going to go to sleep now anyway. So as soon as the GP opens, book an emergency appointment and get straight down there. So I went and I told him everything. And I said, I think this might be linked to the fact that my dad died whilst I was kind of asleep. I don't know. And he literally held his hand up in my face and stopped me and said, what do you want me to do about it? You're a student. You're not supposed to sleep. And then started talking about his problems with sleep.
No.
And now I'm like, if someone said that to me today, I'd be like, right, where's your complaints form? Like, this is ridiculous. But at the time, I was just like, oh, so this is normal. I'm supposed to feel like this. Because he was like, you're a student. You're not supposed to sleep. I was like, oh, so everyone feels like this. But my housemates don't feel like this. And I was just like, and he gave me a
prescription. But also, lack of sleep is such a massive factor in mental health, physical health.
I told him I felt suicidal, and he was like, yeah.
So that even if he wasn't able to, I'm trying to get into his narrow mindset, but even if he was just thinking about what happened to your dad and trying to say, oh, I can't change that, you not being able to sleep has such massive ramifications for your health in general. Mm. And that's his job to help with that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he was having a bad day, but he was horrific. And he gave me a prescription for sleeping pills, but told me, don't you dare collect these. And I was like, what? And I remember he turned his computer around. He was like, look, they come up in red. And I was like, great. He was like, I'm not supposed to prescribe you these. Don't you dare collect them. So I didn't do it. I didn't collect them because I was so scared of him. I don't know why. Oh, and I was just like, and I rang my mum and I was like, I don't know what to do. And she was like, I don't know either. So
but also, I really struggle to see the rationale there. Yeah. If he doesn't think you should take them, why did he prescribe them?
I have absolutely no idea. I'd like to ask him. I have no idea. Absolutely none. If he's listening, feel free to, like, tweet.
Because yeah, I'd love to know. Having to hold back from being like, what's his registration?
Yeah, I know. That's the thing, though. This always frustrates me with anyone who has a bad experience with mental health, is at the time you think you deserve it.
Yeah.
And, like, I felt like, oh, I'm an idiot. I shouldn't have gone to the doctor. Like, he's right, I'm an idiot. Like, so your housemate steps on the floorboard, get over it.
Yeah.
But now, looking back, I'm like, no, what he did was completely wrong. Yeah. And he had no right to speak to me like that. But at the time, a complaint was the furthest thing from my mind. It was all my fault. And I felt like my last hope that I'd been kind of holding off from going to the doctors because I thought maybe it'll just go away, had actually gone. And I was just like, I don't know what to do now. And I went a bit weird and I brought like every book on sleep that there was, thinking that will solve my problems.
Oh, teach myself to
sleep. I was just like, great. So I tried every sleep hygiene thing in the world, every flipping lavender pillow that you could buy, every scented spray, and nothing was working. And I think it was that that meant that things came to such a dramatic head over something so tiny that my housemate beating me to the toilet one morning. It wasn't even that. I jokingly said, "Oh, you bitch," because she cut in front of me and made it to the bathroom. I'm like, "Bitch." And she thought I was being serious, and I wasn't. And I was like, "Oh my God, she hates me. They all wish I'd like go and end my life." And I was just like, "They all hate me. I can't do this anymore. University's so stressful." And I think all of that could have quite easily gone away if I was sleeping, and I wouldn't have reacted that way. But at the time, it was ruining my life. It really was.
And was that something you realised at the time, or much later, the really clear link between your mental health in general and whether or not you were sleeping properly?
I knew that that was what I felt at the time was the cause of it, but I didn't know what to do because I didn't realise that there was anything more wrong. I was just like, as soon as I can get a good night's sleep, I'll stop feeling like this. But that wasn't true. But I was just like, I feel like if in those early months I just got a good night's sleep, I might have been okay. But it got to a point where so many other things had snowballed that a good night's sleep was never going to fix it. But I thought that it was, which wasn't helpful. So it was really difficult when that doctor turned around and said, "Well, so what?" I think he even said, "I work shifts, I don't sleep either." And I was like, "Well, good for you." But I just didn't know what to do anymore. So it just became such a habit that I just wasn't sleeping. And like my mum would ring me and be like, "Did you sleep more than 2 hours last night?" And I'd be like, "No, not really." And if I said like, "Yeah, I slept three," she'd be like, "Oh, that's really good." I'm like, "No, 3 hours sleep is not really good." But I kind of felt like I'd exhausted the one route I went down. It didn't even cross my mind to go to a different doctor and ask them. I was just like, "Well, he said no. I can't go to another one now because he's a doctor."
And that is the, I guess, if we can take one upside from that experience with him, it's that he's in the vast, vast minority and being so awful.
Yeah.
But it's something that all GPs need to bear in mind that although it's their day in, day out seeing people, that 10 to 15 minute appointment can be the biggest thing in somebody's life at that point.
Absolutely.
It could have taken so much to get them to that.
Yeah. And I always think absolute worst case scenario, because I told him that day that I was considering ending my life. I could have walked out of there and done it. And that would have been a result of that interaction. And thankfully, I rang my mum and she calmed me down. I was like, "It's going to be okay. It won't last forever. You know, your body needs sleep. It will do it naturally when it needs to." But I really felt like my only hope had just been pulled from under me and I did not know what to do. And it was the worst feeling in the world.
Yeah. And that's an important thing just to note for the listeners. You can, of course, always ask to speak to a different GP. Equally, if you know you've got a lot to talk about, it may be your first time talking about mental illness, you can request a double length appointment as well, which not everyone realises.
Yes. I think that's the thing I always now as well, if I go to a new GP, I've moved around the country a lot, I always ask, is there anyone that specialises in mental health? Now that I know that that's what I generally need to talk about. And they usually have one, particularly university GPs, they have mental
Absolutely. My aunt is a GP and they've got a community psychiatric nurse based in the practice. And that's perfect because their schedules are quite different. So often she can see a patient and then refer them just down the hall and it's that easy.
Okay.
And that would be so lovely if that was the case for everyone.
Yeah.
And so we are coming near the end of our time here. So in terms of your own experience, I guess with mental health in general, but specifically with somnophobia, are there any things that you found really helpful in terms of your sleep and working through that particular phobia as your life's gone on?
I think understanding where it came from has been the biggest thing. So I wouldn't have been able to tell you all of this 5 years ago when it was all happening. I didn't have a clue that this had all happened and that this was what was causing my problems. That's been really helpful because it's allowed me to then identify the strategies that I need. So what I need is my bedroom to feel like a really safe space. And so I now have lights that I find comforting. I have a weighted blanket in my bedroom.
I really want to get one of those.
They're amazing. It is so, I'd never used one before and I was like, I can't actually justify spending
I'm
this amount
to
of
angle
money.
I'm trying to angle one as a sponsor at the moment.
That is a brilliant idea. But I was just like, it's so much money and what if I don't actually like it? And then I was like, no, I'm just going to try it. And it really is amazing. And I rarely sleep through the night undisturbed, but since I've had it, I do. But I do also take medication, not sleeping pills. My GP was fantastic and she actually suggested that part of the issue I was having is that I was having a lot of racing thoughts and a lot of overthinking before I went to sleep in terms of things that could go wrong. And so she suggested that quetiapine, an antipsychotic medication, mm-hmm. might help to slow those thoughts down. And for me, that in and of itself was life-changing. And I have no idea whether it's a placebo effect or whether it actually works, but I don't care.
You're not going to question it?
No, for me, that really works. And I think I've tried sleeping pills. I've tried zopiclone and diazepam and things like that, and they did not work. But for me, that did work. And it was possibly also the relationship with that doctor. She really took the time to get to know me. She was one of the doctors I asked to see a mental health specialist. And she was fantastic, and she just got it. And she... I think she started to see the connections before I did in terms of my early life and what I was going through with my sleep. And I think she was like, actually, this probably isn't just going to go away through sleep hygiene or, you know, getting up at the same time every day and going to bed at the same time every day. This is more than that. And
right.
So that has been really helpful. But I actually think perhaps having the safe space for me has been so important to know that if I do hear any noises, it's just my partner. And I do kind of, even getting to know noises and knowing what they are comforts me. So I know when it's my partner going to bed or when it's him getting a drink or when it's him going to the toilet, and things like that really help, because I've managed now to calm myself down. I managed to tell myself, you're safe, nothing bad's happening, you're okay, just let it go. And it works. But I think for me, the medication and the creating an environment that works for me have been what's helped me get over it, and I don't suffer with my sleep really anymore. I have periods if I'm particularly stressed, it comes back. Yeah,
and that's
which
a fun,
great.
Vicious cycle of you being stressed, then you're struggling to sleep, then that makes you more stressed.
Yeah.
And there's two things there that I think are really important to highlight. First off, the important distinction of this being a phobia. And so therefore many of the sleep hygiene suggestions won't work, because it's more than just improving your routine. It's something you need to work through, and that's why it's been clearly so powerful, you learning the cause of a lot of this.
Yeah, and like for me, there was a point in my life where sleep was everything I thought about from the moment I woke up to the moment I didn't sleep when I went to bed, and it took over everything. It wasn't like, oh, I get into bed and I start thinking about that argument I had last week. It was so much more than that. It took over everything.
Yeah.
And I think that, like you said, that is the distinction. It's not, oh, you feel a little bit anxious, try a lavender pillow. It's like, no, this is actually serious now, and sleep hygiene isn't going to work.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to highlight there was you mentioning the power of asking for someone that specializes in mental health with the GP, because for anyone that may be going to the GP for the first time to talk about mental health specifically, it might be quite daunting, the idea of going into that new situation with demands. But actually, from the GP's perspective, if their specialty or their particular interest is mental illnesses, then that's an area they can really shine. And so them having another patient in an area they're particularly interested and skilled in is somewhere where they can really excel, rather than getting another bunion to deal with, which I struggle to think of many GPs that need to deal with more bunions. As an example,
I always say half the battle with the GP is convincing them of your symptoms, and so if they're already a specialist in mental health, you don't have to do the convincing. You can just spend the time telling them what's going on for you.
Yeah, of course all GPs should have that basic understanding, but there's no harm in asking the questions. And so we'll wrap up there. Is there anywhere you'd most want to direct listeners to if they want to learn more about you?
I would say my Twitter, because I don't really know how to use Instagram at all. So my Twitter handle is @beyondbpd80, and you can find everything else from there anyway.
Great. And it's really good. I can personally endorse the Twitter because we retweet it all the time.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been so lovely.
I've really enjoyed it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.